I tried to imagine their lives backward from the moment they stepped into that line. I wondered what they'd had to say or do to find themselves there, and how many of those steps they wished they could take back. I was always wondering about somebody else's regrets. "You should be nicer to your mother." My grandmother spoke to me, but looked straight ahead in line. We were the same height now, and I turned to her, confused. Then I was mad. She didn't even know the whole story. She was taking my mother's side of an argument she hadn't seen, heard, or even been told about. I closed my eyes and felt a tug in the air above me, like I was being lifted. I began to move my feet in a rhythm, rolling from heel to toe, standing in place. To anyone else, a bored teen shifting feet from side to side. To me, a soothing motion I'd learned from marching band, a way to stay inside myself when my big feelings tried to push me out. When I felt safely tethered again, I spoke, trying to keep my voice measured. "Yes, we need to be nicer in the house, but I disagree that it needs to come from me." I knew my grandmother was baiting me, offended I hadn't opened up earlier. But I tried to defend myself without offering any details about what had gone down between me and my mother. Maybe she just wanted to hear me talk about what was on my mind, but I denied her. And even though I felt I was ultimately right, I didn't want to see her upset by my caginess. Lost in my thoughts, I didn't notice my grandmother's face ripple with frustration. "You need to be nicer to your mother because you don't even know why your daddy is in prison." Her hard tone should have been a warning sign that now was not the time to talk about whatever she was suddenly willing to confess. But my curiosity blinded me. I wasn't sure yet that I wanted to know, but I hadn't been this close to an answer since that car ride with Uncle Clarence. He'd already been so good to us by bringing us to visit our father. It would have felt ungrateful to push him on the subject. But I didn't bring it up this time. My grandmother did. I wanted to know more than I was afraid to know. My chances of it coming up again anytime soon were slim. "Why is he in prison?" I took the shot I had and waited for her to answer. "He raped two women." My grandmother blurted it out like it was just another nasty piece of gossip. My feet stilled. I masked my face, showed no emotion. I didn't want my grandmother to decide I couldn't handle what I'd heard, which I wasn't sure I could. In my family, showing too much emotion got you labeled. I'd been told I was too sensitive for a long time. And I didn't want to prove anybody right. Crying in a mall food court wouldn't help. There was always the chance that if I looked like I might fall apart, she would stop talking. I didn't want her to stop talking. I didn't speak. After a few moments of silence, she added, "Don't tell your brother." I rubbed my gurgling stomach. Aside from the pain I felt in my middle, I'd gone numb from head to toe. My body continued to move, but once again, with the sense it had left some irretrievable part of myself behind us. Gone and here. Between here and gone. Always alone. I told my grandmother I didn't want anything to eat anymore. That was not a lie. This was an old game we played, my grandmother and I. She told me secrets, and I pretended to have never heard them. The game usually started differently. Usually, she would begin by telling me something, then stopping before adding details, peering at me from the side of her eyes and saying, "Nah, I ain't gonna say nothing else, 'cause you'll tell it. You always tell things." And I would protest, "No, I don't tell things." Then she would mention a time I did repeat something I shouldn't have, most likely an example from a time before I was 6 years old, and I would defend myself as not a 6-year-old. And then, finally, she would finish. The reveal was rarely worth the work, but it felt so good to have someone want to tell me secrets and trust me with them. This one, I regretted knowing. This one, I tried to forget. Not because I should, but because I really, really wanted to. I tried to not make a memory of that day. I'd been too curious. I'd spoken and let the demon in. I kept myself from crying for the rest of the trip while my grandmother pretended not to watch my face. I was good at this. Control your breath, quiet your heart, die on the inside. Only let them see life. Normal life. I stayed steady until 5 minutes after walking through the front door of my mother's house. I picked up the cordless phone and called Brett. I asked if I could come over for a moment. He said I could. I set down the phone, turned back toward the front door, and I left. I walked to Brett's parents' house on autopilot. I crossed roads without looking both ways. Brett was waiting for me. I saw his head through the little windows at the top of the door. I put on a bright smile and waved to his mother, who was smoking a cigarette and curling her hair at the kitchen table. We walked the 3 stairs down into the den and sat on a love seat. Then I told him everything I could, which wasn't much, before dissolving. He scooped me up and cradled me in his lap. He rocked me back and forth and whispered into my hair, "I'm so sorry, Ashley. I'm so sorry." I shivered and shook against his chest, and he held me. He didn't let me go. That night, I dreamed I'd lost my glasses in the shallow woods next to my mother's house. I dreamed I ran through the night, aware that I was being chased, but unable to name or describe my assailant. Without my glasses, I couldn't find my way through the trees in the dark, and I panicked more and more with every step. Eventually, I would convince myself to sit wherever I stood and wait for the sunrise or for whatever was coming to find me in the dark. Chapter 19. Brett and I were best friends, and after hating him, then 2 years of pining for him, I finally worked up the nerve to ask him if he liked me. He responded, "I do, but there's more to it than that." What kind of cryptic-ass answer was that? I thought. When he couldn't explain what he meant, he asked me to be his girlfriend instead. Good enough for me. I knew I loved him when I walked into the band room and watched him playing the saxophone, his fingers moving deftly over the keys. We started dating a few months after I told him about my father. Sometimes he asked me how I was feeling about my grandmother's confession. I don't remember what I said, but I must have lied. I tried not to feel anything about what I'd learned, and I did a very good job of that for a long time. Sometimes I couldn't help it. In the stillness of the nights that kept on coming at the end of every day, no matter how pleasant or productive the day had been, I wondered if something was wrong with me for ever loving my father in the first place. It made sense why everyone who knew the truth couldn't look me in the eyes when I asked. They didn't want me to feel ashamed, but they already felt ashamed for me. I saw it on their faces, pointed in my direction. My father's crimes repulsed me, and I felt for some reason that I should have known better. I convinced myself something about his letters, his drawings, or the tone of his voice should have revealed to me what he'd done, and I hadn't noticed because I hadn't wanted to. It made sense to me. Every once in a while, my mother and I would find ourselves in the living room at the same time, watching some Lifetime original movie. Rape was in the central plot line of 75% of them. A few times, I caught myself wishing, out of everything it might be, that my father was not a rapist. It was my biggest fear before it was my reality. And the thought that he might have, I didn't think. I wished. You should have known then, I thought, that something was wrong with anybody who loved you that much. All my life, my father represented love to me, deep, enduring, irrevocable love. So many times I thought all the problems of my life could be solved if I just had him there to hold me and tell me who I am and how much he loved that person. I never imagined pain coming from my father or the mistakes he might have made as a present parent. My naivete shamed me, and I accepted that shame as my own. In the dark, at night, the saddest part of me assumed my father's crimes were the source of the crime committed upon me. This was the only way I knew to make the connection between what my father had done to the women he raped and what had happened to me in the shed. I relied on Brett to distract me from both of them. Brett loved me. He was right, though. There was more to it than that. In the aftermath of the shed, the books I found assured me of something I knew in my mind but couldn't feel in my body. I hadn't wanted what happened to me to happen to me. This was important because in the movies I watched with my mother, the women who had been raped stopped wanting to have sex. I hadn't. I thought about having sex with Brett all the time, and I worried that meant something was wrong with me. I felt like the wrong kind of victim. As much as my mother, teachers, cousins, grandmother, and classmates had already spoken to me about the mechanics and morals of sex, no one ever mentioned that rape isn't sex. What Bradley did to me, what his friend watched being done to me from the corner of my mother's shed, wasn't in any way the same as what I wanted Brett to do with me. All of those books with white girls on their covers in the teen section of the Hessen Castle branch of the Allen County Library taught me the difference. There was no one in the whole world who made me feel safer than Brett. If I was going to find out if the books were right, he would be the best person for me to learn that with. I lay in Brett's bed, naked from the waist down, waiting for him to raid his sister's room for a condom, and replayed how I'd found myself there. I'd always thought it would be important to me to have candles, soft music, or at the very least, shaved armpits when I finally chose to have sex. But in that moment, none of it seemed necessary. I was 16 and happily swept up in a hormonal undertow. Brett was kind and he was gentle. He would not make fun of me for my armpits. He never made crude comments about women, and he never pressured me into sexual situations I didn't want to be in. I trusted him to handle me with care. And I had something to prove. When he found the condom and got under the covers with me, the warmth of his bare skin against mine spread to every part of my body. My muscles relaxed when he kissed me, slowly, and asked me if I was okay. I nodded, encouraging him to continue. The hands of a musician move over anything they love like an instrument. Brett was so controlled when and where he applied pressure to my body. His touch was deliberate and gentle, and by the time our bodies joined, I was more than ready to welcome him. The minutes passed in a blur, and with love and patience, I received one of the greatest gifts of my life. The deep knowledge that I had had sex with my own intent and will, and it had been like nothing I had ever experienced before. nothing. Chapter 20. Too many parts of my life seemed unpredictable, much too dependent on the moods and inclinations of others. To wrangle my days and weeks into something consistent seemed out of my reach. I was hanging on, surviving by slipping in and out of the lives of those around me, tagging along, getting rides, hanging out, and being around without ever really sticking around. There was no schedule to survival. I pulled myself together to push for a B average, sometimes less, but really only so I didn't embarrass Brett, who was on track to become valedictorian. Band was the most consistent thing in my life, but even that only motivated me so much. School felt like practice for white-collar prison, and I couldn't really pretend to care as much as it would take to make everybody happy. I continued to read everything I could get my hands on, especially if it hadn't been assigned in class. My teachers were frustrated, but for the most part, they liked me and thought I was smart enough to engage. A few of them talked to me about going to college, but it was a touchy subject. I loved the idea of going to college, but the reality was I didn't think we'd be able to afford it. And when I thought of the reason why, I had to swallow hard and try not to burst into tears. Back in middle school, every day for a week, I asked my mother to submit my paperwork for 21st Century Scholars, a state program that promised to pay the college tuition of low-income students who maintained at least a C average through graduation and then attended an in-state school. A few of my teachers, Mr. Martin included, had pulled me aside multiple times to make sure I was getting the form signed and turned in. He asked if I wanted him to call my mother, to nudge her. I made it very clear that would not help me. If my mom thought I was talking about her not doing something, especially with my teachers, I wouldn't hear the end of it. The time she'd spend being mad would be more time than I wanted to deal with it. The last time I asked my mother about the papers, she told me if I asked for them again, she would throw them away. She never mentioned them after that, and I made myself stop thinking about it too. On the day of the deadline for submission, I hid from the teachers who were most likely to ask me what happened. I didn't want to tell them my mother forgot. I didn't want them judging and talking about either of us for not being able to get it together. Even when it was the truth, she would never forgive me if I told these strangers she'd messed this up. For months afterward, I walked past those teachers in the hallway, reluctant to meet their eyes, terrified I would find them looking for answers and that I would be persuaded to provide them. College seemed like the kind of experience you had to plan, and I already knew I was no good at making or having plans or keeping plans, and I had no one to make or keep them for me. If I was going to go to college, I was on my own, and I had no faith in my ability to be enough to get it done. In some ways, I'd already given up. There always seemed to be some more urgent need right in front of me at school or at home. My mother's house could be as peaceful as it could be chaotic. It just depended on whatever happened that day. Not one of us was immune from coming home carrying the ire of some earlier confrontation with a classmate, coworker, or other irritant. On the worst days, we carried on for hours, yelling, hitting, hiding, crying, talking, and hiding again. We rushed through rapid cycles of joyful bonding and soul-stunning violence, but it was never on the calendar, and I never knew when it was coming. If anybody in our house had a plan, nobody let me know. Those bad days seemed to come less often once I started spending more time away from home, but I had to have good reasons to be gone. In theory, my mother believed in trusting me until I gave her a reason not to. In practice, like most other mothers I knew, She needed to know where I was going to be, who was going to be there, who their parents were, and how long I'd be gone. I still had more freedom than most of the other girls I knew and began to feel like something might be shifting between my mother and me. Even though I didn't have dazzling grades, I made up for it in my mind by being involved in every student group where I might have even the slightest interest, as long as the schedule didn't compete with marching band. I was spending more and more time in practices, rehearsals, and club meetings, but on the rare occasion I was home before she went to work her night shift as a correctional officer, my mother might stop me in the hallway and say, "You know I'm proud of you, right?" And while the delivery would be a little aggressive, I would smile and say, "Yeah, Mama, I know." Then she would remind me of a chore I needed to do or bring up something else that had nothing to do with how she really felt about me. I knew she missed me. I thought that was the only reason we were getting along. A friend told me she was going to visit her boyfriend in Muncie on the Ball State University campus and asked if maybe I wanted to come along. Her boyfriend had also been in band my first summer, but he'd already graduated by the time I got to high school. Though she was a year behind him, they had kept dating, and I admired their long-distance commitment. My freedom may have extended beyond the boundaries of my peers, but there was no way my mother was going to let her teenage daughter drive down to a college campus for an evening of whatever the hell. I was about to say never mind when I heard Alan laugh somewhere on the other side of my bedroom door. The sound grated against my inner ear like an abrasive pestle. "I'll ask my mom if I can come. I'll call you back." I didn't want to be home. Alan was often present, working on somebody's car he kept in my mother's garage, and I didn't think I could handle spending any more time around him. I called my mother and told her I had to perform in a neighboring county with the band. I may have even named Bluffton, though it was too early in the season for that parade. I knew she wouldn't know either way. She usually didn't ask too many questions about band trips because Mr. Caffey was the only white man she trusted for miles, and I had never lied about them before. I said my friend would pick me up and bring me back home. My friends were usually utterly charmed by my mother. She was her most magnetic around them, or anyone else on the outside, really. But this friend had met my mother when she was wearing her correctional officer uniform, and she'd been afraid of her ever since. I knew my mom liked it. "It's better," my mother said, "that she worries about what I will do to her if something happens to you." If my mother found out about the lie, I knew she would come down on me. Too far down the road, I thought. The consequences of your actions here are too far down the road. The ride into campus, just as the sun set on the bell tower, felt enchanted like the opening scene of a teen rom-com. It occurred to me no one would be able to tell I was a high school student. I was excited to pretend, if only to myself, to be someone more than who I was, like a student with direction and a notebook full of plans. Someone starting over. We met my friend's boyfriend in his dorm room, and he already looked older to me. He drove us all to a local pizza place, nestled in a little collection of campus-adjacent restaurants, bars, cafes, and shops, appropriately referred to as the Village. After pizza, we went back to his dorm room to hang out for a bit, but hit the road back to Fort Wayne before too long. Our stay wasn't more than a few hours, but to me, the whole place was out of a storybook, quaint and magnificent. On the way home, my friend told me she'd applied to Ball State and had gotten in. I was happy for her, that she'd gotten what she wanted. I told her that was the first college campus I'd ever really been on. When I got back, my mother never suspected a thing. I used my key to unlock the garage door, tiptoed through the living room, and crept into the kitchen to quietly release the cordless phone from its cradle. Undetected, I slipped back into my bedroom and called Brett. When I confessed to him what I'd done, I told him being on campus made me think I might try to go to college. He released a breath on the other end of the line. Of course you're going to college, Ashley. That was news to me. My mother had always said I could be whatever I wanted, but she felt no need to push me. If I said I was bad at math, she agreed, and I continued to do my best, now with a confirmed belief that I was bad at math. I wasn't sure how hard I was supposed to try to develop skills I saw as hopeless. My mother wanted me to have my own dreams, so she feared dreaming too big on my behalf. My mother was always in my business, she would say. I'm not doing that to my kids. Nobody else had set a college expectation for me. I assume for the same reasons I hadn't set one for myself. I wasn't a little kid anymore, and aside from Brett and my friends, I didn't even get birthday presents anymore. Who was supposed to have money for me to go to college? You'll find that out after you apply and get accepted. Brett's tone sounded like I should know better, but he didn't want to hurt my feelings by just saying that. If you get in, then you can apply for financial aid. Jesus, Ashley, you have to try. Why wouldn't you? Later that week, I went to the public library and started researching options for an academic future I wanted but hadn't dared to dream of. I was tired of being disappointed, and it seemed that disappointment started with wanting things. I tried not to want. There was a new program at our school where a few students were chosen to spend half the day, twice a week, taking a course at the local community college. The other 3 days of the week, we would meet with tutors who would help with our coursework. We'd all been selected based on our testing scores, and since it was a small school, I knew everyone else who had been chosen. The class would be free for us, but the credits would count toward a degree should we go on to pursue one. I signed up for the college class to prove a point. My current English teacher pulled me out into the hallway on the first day of class and told me she knew what kind of kid I was, that I hung out with smart kids to get away with rudeness. She told me exactly how I was going to behave if I wanted to stick around. I told her if she didn't take her finger out of my face, I was going to keep it. The principal told me I was too smart to be acting out. I told him he hires teachers who don't like children. What started in middle school as normal teenage expressions of anti-authoritarianism, or as many of those as a black girl has access to, exploded into full-on contempt for most of my teachers and administrators by the time I was a junior in high school. There were a few teachers who I respected and felt truly cared either for me or the student population they served. Everyone else, I had reason to believe, was only here to assert power in unnecessarily cruel ways. I counted that English teacher among the latter. I confronted her, and my principal, with tall and hollow confidence. I knew I had almost no power in this interaction. I knew my mother wouldn't have my back in this situation, but my anger didn't care. The only time my mother took my side was when a teacher tried to tell me a book was too advanced or too old for me, but that hadn't happened since elementary school. Now, my mother called me sneaky. "You like to try people," she would say to me, peeping at me from the corners of her eyes, her head turned slightly away. "You just like to mess with people until they don't have any choice but to do something crazy." I wanted to defend myself. But then I thought of everyone around me who had lost their minds a little, and I decided not to lie. No, my mother would be no help here. I thought of one of my classmates who often found herself called out by teachers. If they riled her up too much, she'd start to scream, "Call my daddy! I want to talk to my daddy!" And even though we were all 17 years old, sometimes someone called him. He always came to the school to be on her side. I thought that was ridiculous, and I wished I had it for myself. For the rest of the day, I sat in in-school suspension, daydreaming about myself in a different life, a better one, with better teachers, books, and my dad. Not my dad who was sitting in a prison somewhere for his crimes, but the one who still existed in the place I floated off to when I needed peace. He was the one I kept hold of, the one I was still trying to get to call me his favorite girl. It occurred to me, I could take that version of him with me wherever I went. Maybe I didn't have to be afraid to leave, to pursue something more. If he only existed in my head, he could find me anywhere. When the time came, I applied to one community college, Ball State University, and one dream school. I found my mother's tax documents in the nightstand next to her bed, in the same drawer where I sometimes found old letters from my dad I didn't remember, or that weren't meant for me in the first place. She told me they were there when I told her I needed them to fill out something called the FAFSA. That's how I found out my mother was raising 4 kids with no financial assistance on less than $40,000 a year. The guidance counselor who was supposed to help me finish the forms kept shaking his head and saying, "This is going to be hard on your mother." I didn't know what he was talking about. Everything was already hard on everybody. Chapter 21. My Ball State University acceptance letter arrived in a thick cardinal red envelope. I took it into my bedroom, closed the door behind me, and opened it alone. When I saw the word, "Congratulations," I knew. Thump, 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 my blood rang in my ears and drowned out the world. Because I was by myself, I allowed a wide grin to spread out across my face. I held the letter to my chest and squealed instead of screaming. Even if it didn't work out, even if I never got to step on campus as a student, I'd been accepted to college. I had been accepted. I told Brett first. "I knew it," he said. I could hear him smiling. I wanted to wait to tell my mother until I could figure out how to ask her to help with the $125 housing deposit to secure my room in the dormitories where freshmen were required to live for at least their first year. I'd been working at the mall part-time for almost 3 years, but the money seemed to leak from my bank account no matter how many times and ways I tried to save. I had a job, but felt deeply afraid to drive. My grandmother hadn't had a driver's license for as long as I'd been alive, and yet somehow she continued to be the worst backseat driver in the Midwest. "Just let your boyfriend drive you," she'd tell me. "Men are just better at that kind of thing." But after years of shuffling me from here to there, Brett remembered he wasn't actually my parent and refused to continue to be my chauffeur. My mother, not wanting to have to drive me around herself, gave me her Pontiac Bonneville and bought a used car that was new to her. I didn't have to pay for the car, but I was responsible for the insurance, and that seemed more than fair, definitely more than I'd ever expected. My mother was relieved to have me paying for my own gas, outings, band fees, doctor's appointments, and most of my own food. It felt good to me to pay my own way when I could, like I was finally offering my mother the relief she'd earned. But I knew I would need help with this housing deposit, and I knew asking her would be its own minefield. If she could help me, she would do so happily. That was the best and least likely scenario. If she couldn't help, she wouldn't say so, but she would eventually get angry with me for asking. Sometimes she would tell me that she could help, but when I followed up, she would claim I was harassing her, and now, because of my nagging, she didn't want to do it at all. Asking for help could go wrong in so many ways in my house, but this was college. I'd been accepted, and despite all I'd taught myself about wanting less and needing less, I couldn't pretend I didn't want to chase this dream. I couldn't pretend I didn't want to see what might be possible for me. It was worth the risk. My mother was in the living room. I walked in holding the letter in both hands. It required every bit of my ability to focus to maintain a normal gait, keep from fidgeting, and stabilize my voice. I walked toward her and stopped just to the right of her. "Mom?" She stopped folding clothes and looked at me, her expression more cautious than curious, as usual. "What?" she asked. I handed her the letter first, but before she could open the envelope, I said, "I got accepted to Ball State." My mother leaped from the couch and screamed, "Yes!" She pumped her arms up and down, her face stunned and eyes wide. It wasn't surprising that she would be happy for me, but this was something else. She spun. I would have spun with her if I could have stopped myself from watching her revel in the good news. My good news. She pulled me into an embrace so quickly, I felt bad for how I stiffened in response. She held me close, kissed my cheek, and I allowed my face to melt into her shoulder. I felt smothered in the intermingled smell of coffee, cigarettes, and cherry almond-scented Jergens. I felt ashamed of my need to stay there and my inability to simply be grateful for the moment. My mother didn't let me go. She whispered in my ear, "I knew it. I knew you could do it." When I told her about the deposit, to my surprise, she smiled and even laughed a little. "We'll figure it out. Don't you worry." I worried anyway. But before the deadline came, she handed me a check for the full amount. I didn't even have to follow up. She went all out for my graduation party. She did so much I worried it would make her grouchy, but she remained in good spirits the whole day. We had a pool party in her sister's backyard, and even though all my friends came ready to party, I couldn't wear a bathing suit in front of all those people. My mother spent hundreds of dollars on the food, and as I bit into my uncle's ribs, smothered in his super-secret barbecue sauce, I remembered why the smoky meat had become synonymous with celebration in my mind. I finished my first plate in a hurry, then rushed back for seconds before people started making plates to take home. Right before I walked into the kitchen, someone took me by the elbow and pulled me into the hallway. "Ash," my grandpa whispered. He looked left to right and past my shoulders, then smiled like he'd already gotten away with something. There was no one around, but I whispered back, "What's up?" He held out his hand, palm up. In the center was a small plastic bag of what I assumed was weed. Until that moment, I hadn't seen it up close, but that wasn't because I wasn't interested. Nobody ever offered it to me, and even if they had, my mother told me she'd done it once and it made her see demons in the faces of her friends. I told my grandpa I didn't smoke, and he looked disappointed before saying full volume, "Well, shit, that's what I got you for graduation." He walked back into the kitchen and started prematurely making a plate to go, which meant he'd probably leave without saying goodbye. Usually people waited until closer to the end of an event to prepare a plate, but my grandpa always seemed to think there wouldn't be enough left for him unless he came and took his before everyone else. I watched him piling food on the styrofoam and wondered when it would be enough. Just then, Brett came around the corner and asked me to take a walk with him. "You want me to leave my party?" He looked uncomfortable. "Just come to my car." We walked across the cul-de-sac my aunt and uncle lived on to Brett's car parked at an angle, the passenger side mirror mere inches from taking out the neighbor's mailbox. Brett opened his door and riffled around inside for a moment before emerging with nothing. No, it was still in his hand. A box. A box. I considered that Brett may be about to propose, but nothing about it made sense. Blood pulsed through my ears, drowning out the world and revealing to me a clear moment of unfiltered knowing of what I wanted. For so long, Brett had been my anchor of expectation, and in my mind, my only way out of my mother's house. We talked about getting married before, but well into the future. He was my best friend, and I loved him, but he was no longer the only thing I had going for me. I had gotten into college. I didn't need to belong to him or anybody else to be on my way somewhere I'd never been before. I begged myself, if he asks, be strong enough to say no. He laughed at the look on my face, watching me spiral, maybe even pleased by the obvious severity of my response. He took my hand. I'm not proposing. He opened the box. Inside was a ring. I didn't even let myself take it in before I started to pull my hand away, but Brett held on to me. It's not a marry me ring, he said. It's an I'm proud of you ring. He took it out and presented it to me. A white gold band with a sapphire in the center, my favorite gemstone, and two almost microscopic diamonds flanking its sides. The panic left my body and I took it in fully. It was beautiful. I loved it. He put it on my right hand ring finger and it fit. When we walked back into the house, the kitchen was full of people loading up on more macaroni and cheese, cornbread, and barbecue. My father's sister asked where we'd been, and I showed her my ring in response. My mother said it was beautiful, but she made me promise we weren't engaged. I promised. My grandpa hugged me, then handed me $50. I sold that shit, he whispered. Right before graduation, one of my favorite teachers, Miss R., had gotten engaged. She was going to be moving to Chicago to marry a man who loved music as much as she did. She and I had bonded my freshman year over Romeo and Juliet and fashion magazines. It felt right that if I was ending my time at our high school, then she would be too. I visited her at home after my party. She was packing up all of her records, vintage furniture, and other everyday trappings. She had bags of things she wanted to give me, and I was happy to take them all. After I'd loaded two hefties full of clothes, shoes, and handbags into my trunk, I showed her my ring. Miss R. looked at my ring for a long time. She held out her right hand and asked me if I remembered the ring she wore there. I did. I'd noticed it years earlier. She told me she'd bought it as a reminder that she could take care of herself. I repeated the memory to her, and she smiled, pleased. She took the ring off and put it in my palm, closing my fingers over it. She held my hand like that for a long while. Brett is very nice, and that is a beautiful ring. But you have your own diamond. You don't need one from anybody else. Chapter 22. The day I left for Ball State, my mother melted down. By the time I returned home from saying my farewells to Brett with mutual promises to make the long-distance thing work, she was whipped into a frenzy about something my grandmother had said to or about Alan. I was going by the bits and pieces of conversation I'd picked up on the other side of the phone call she was having with one of my aunts. I assumed at some point she would get off the phone and help me load the car with my things. She didn't. When the car was loaded, I thought she'd hang up while I hugged my brothers goodbye. My sister and I had gone to hug when my mother told her to get into the car too. Why am I going? My sister looked confused. I just wanted to get on the road. My mother glared at her until she got into the car and I followed. My mother handed one of my brothers the phone and got in the driver's seat. We pulled out of the driveway, down the street, and onto a main road. When we stopped for gas, someone waved at my mother, and she flashed them a smile as big and bright as all outside. During the ride to campus, my mother mostly fussed to herself about whatever she'd been talking about on the phone. I stared out the window and counted the mile markers until I lost count and I was gone again. My mother's voice faded into the background of my thoughts, and I pictured my new life on the other side of this car ride. Despite all my reading, my imaginings of college came from television and film, where parents cried when they dropped their kids off. They took photos or videos, and they said things they'd been meaning to say, or things they said every day but were suddenly desperate for their child to remember. Silly thoughts and dreams. I hated myself for wanting them to be real, and for believing they ever could have been. I hoped college would be some place I learned my lessons the first time. It wasn't a long drive, and soon we pulled up to my dorm, entering the scramble of campus newbies, with creepily cheerful RAs chatting up parents. As others were hauling large suitcases down hallways and upstairs, I easily filled one rolling cart with all of my belongings and moved them up to my new room with the help of my sister. My mother scowled behind us the entire time. We pushed the cart through the door, and since my roommate had already set up her side of the room, my side was clearly designated. It didn't take long to unload everything from the rolling cart, and as soon as we did, an RA popped out of another room and asked to borrow it to help the next student. My sister wheeled it over to her, and I turned to my mother. I asked if maybe she and my sister wanted to stay and eat a meal before they left. She avoided my gaze and shook her head. "I don't want to wait around. I don't like to drive in the dark." My sister hugged me goodbye, then my mother wrapped one arm around me and kissed my cheek. "Love you," she said. "Love you too, Mama." I watched her disappear down the hall, then walked back into my dorm room alone. I did not feel afraid, though. I felt free. My love for my family was in direct conflict with my need to be gone, out, and away. My oldest brother and I, for many years, were best friends. Moving away made it hard to get him on the phone. He always preferred to drop in and speak in person, but I was not there. When I occasionally came home, I hugged and kissed them all until they'd wriggle away from me. "Ash, stop, seriously, oh my God." Every text, tweet, or Facebook message I sent them was filled with exclamation points and smiley faces. My wish and my primary motivation was that my adventures would inspire their own. I swept into family gatherings during the holidays, a walking banner. "Family, you can do this too. You can do anything I can do." But each time I left campus to come home, I spent 10 minutes in the mirror reciting the same phrase like my therapist had taught me. "I like myself the way I am. I like myself the way I am. I like myself the way I am. I like myself the way I am." Then I would promise myself not to forget. This is the first conversation I've ever had with a Black person. So, like, thanks? It was really nice. I stared at the girl standing across from me. What was I supposed to say in response? "You're welcome" felt wrong. She was blonde and freckled, and we'd been talking for over an hour in the study room at the end of the hall. I hadn't been a college student for long before it occurred to me that white people could grow up in a place where they never had to interact with Black people. I forced a smile, not knowing what else to do, as she waltzed out of the room, unaware, even proud of herself for taking the giant leap of directly addressing a Negro. Up until college, the school system I attended was always over 80% Black. That wasn't the case here. Here, I was one of only three young Black women on my dormitory floor, and that made our floor stacked. My roommate and I were the only students on our hall who didn't own their own personal computers. It was easy enough to make do with the computer labs, and though it was something I noticed, it didn't seem like a reason to complain. Some of the other kids were getting bi-weekly visits from their parents, whereas I couldn't imagine anyone being able to afford that much gas. It was nice to have a break from family. For the first time, I felt grateful not to have parents or guardians who insisted on constantly checking in on me. Walking through the village in Muncie, I would see someone sitting with their parents on the patio of a restaurant. Sometimes I would feel the familiar pangs of longing, but more often it was sympathy. It was hard for me to imagine that the child might be having a nice time with their parents, even if they were good at faking it. I thought, I am freer than you, and that is worth all the things I don't have. I was alone in a college town, managing and caring for myself with limited guidance. I did not find ease, but I did find temporary moments of peace. I had more direct control of my comings and goings than I'd ever had before. I could plainly see where I was already lagging behind others when it came to material wealth and how the impact of my decisions would be tempered by that fact. But for the first time in my entire life, I didn't feel watched. My mistakes, however big or small, to the people around me were just mistakes. I was never accused of plotting against anyone's well-being or attempting to ruin their day. For weeks at a time, I didn't hear anyone scream in anger, and if I did, it was never directed at me, so I felt I had nothing to fear. On campus, cloaked in the protection of emerging adulthood, I did not feel the need to court a new kind of chaos, and so chaos had to work to find me. College became, as it has for so many others, a refuge as much as a resource. I woke for my 8 a.m. course, an introduction to the fashion major, 3 times a week, never showed up late, and sat in the front row. I joined a community service-focused organization called Student Voluntary Services and used the work-study I'd been awarded in my financial aid package to join AmeriCorps part-time. I considered joining the band for about half a second, but I knew I wouldn't sign up. It wasn't my band with my bandmates, and I didn't want to have that experience with anybody else. Then, after meeting with a professor in my apparel design program and being dissuaded from continuing down that path, I considered changing my major to psychology. My mom would kill me if I changed my major, one of my classmates offered when I told her my plan. It hadn't occurred to me to mention it to my mother. When I did, she said, "Oh, well, as long as it's what you want to do." I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I was intoxicated with the freedom to decide for myself when so many of my more fortunate classmates didn't have that option. My freedom to choose, unwatched, became precious to me, and I felt like I might float right out of my shoes. My roommate and I grew close, bonding over our being broke and determined. My dorm room started to feel like my whole world, the new home base of my real life. My dining card was a marvel. Being able to swipe for food whenever I got hungry, no matter how much actual money I had access to, felt like I'd made it to the other side of hard times. What had once been scarce now felt plentiful, but the old feelings always found a way back. While browsing in one of the dining halls, I noticed my favorite flavor of bottled tea in a section of the refrigerated beverages. The fridge was usually full, but there were only 3 bottles of the tea I liked left. I bought them all at once. When I came back the next day, there were only 3 again. So I bought those too. By the end of the week, our mini fridge was full, and I was keeping bottles of tea lined up under my twin bed just in case I went back for them, expecting them to be there, and discovered them all gone. I tried not to think about what might be happening back in my mother's home. I tried to call only when I had good news. I didn't want anyone to worry about me, even though usually nobody did. I learned the details of any family drama weeks or even months after the drama occurred. Most of my family was so used to everyone living around the corner, used to random but regular impromptu visits to each other's living rooms for a long chat. They stopped telling me things in real time because they didn't think to reach out. It wasn't intentional. I just wasn't there to run into. Except for my grandmother, of course, who called more often than anyone else, just to say, "Don't do anything stupid, and I love you." Brett started classes at the community college where we had taken courses in high school. With my encouragement, he joined the theater program. The way he talked about performance made me miss our times when we'd perform together. We spoke on the phone every day, even as we were pulled into our own distinct groups of friends. I still felt a kind of desperate hunger for him, but I could also feel the threads that bound us being cut, one by one, by the days passing and the empty space on the phone line before we said goodnight. When I asked him why he felt so far from me, even on the weekends when he visited me or took me back to Fort Wayne, he looked into my eyes and asked, "Why do you need something to be wrong?" And I wondered why I did. Chapter 23. I went home when my great-grandpa Morris died. I didn't know how to feel. When my grandmother and I lived in Missouri, he hadn't been kind to me as a rule, but he had worried when my grandmother thought my fever was too high. That was the day I saw him hovering in the bedroom door as I laid on my side, arms and legs splayed out, drenched in sweat, telling my grandmother Jesus had come to him in a bubble and said I was going to be okay. When I caught his eyes that day, he looked away from me and whispered to my grandmother, "The fever made me bold, and I asked what he'd said. She wouldn't tell me." When he died, he left everything to her. He'd been living in a retirement community for a while, refusing to sell his land to encroaching developers. My grandmother had always told me she would eventually leave the farm to me, but when she called to ask if I had any interest in it, I couldn't really remember what it looked like. I remembered how it felt and how it made me feel, but the terrain itself had vanished from my memory. It didn't make sense to go back anyway. I was done with that dream and was looking for a new one now. I told her to sell it, and she did. With part of the earnings from the land sale, my grandmother moved out of my mother's house and bought her own. It was a lovely 3-bedroom, 1.5-bathroom ranch, just a 4-minute drive away from where she lived with us. She couldn't wait to show it to me, and I couldn't wait to see it. The first thing she showed me was a small room with twin beds. "This is the guest room," she said. "Or, you know, your room, when you're here." She tossed the last part behind her as she walked back toward the living room. I smiled. I never was surprised when she made room for me. After my grand tour of the house, I went back to my mother's. As soon as I walked through the door, she started yelling at me about my bags in the family room. There was nowhere else for them to go, but apparently, I hadn't left them in the right place. Before I'd even fully moved out, when I was working at a Boy Scout camp outside the city the summer before college, my mother moved boxes of my belongings into the garage to make room for my siblings and my grandmother, who was still living there at the time. Usually, when she got like this, I got quiet and slipped away, but it wasn't working. I couldn't ignore her. My brain wouldn't drown her out, and I felt stuck. No one yelled at me or even raised their voice to me at college, and I was out of practice dealing with the way it made me feel. She hadn't hit me in years, but when she yelled and screamed and raged, the fear of it crept over me like ice, and I hardened into defensive mode. A few weeks of not having to take anybody's shit, and I got really bad at taking it, especially as it dawned on me that she couldn't make me stay there. For the first time, as my mother attempted to draft me into this familiar dance, I could just leave. I asked her to stop yelling. As expected, that made her yell more. Who the fuck do you think you are? She paced back and forth in the kitchen, eyes fixed on me, perched on the couch. You don't come back here and tell me what you want me to do. I started to laugh, and she stopped pacing, but kept scowling. It's fine, I threw up my hands. I don't have to stay here. Grandma has a room for me. I'll be over there. My mother trailed behind me as I grabbed my bags and headed for the door. Yeah, you just stay your ass over there. Better for you to be over there than starting shit over here. I got into my car and drove away from my mother's house and the last thought of it as my home. Chapter 24. Talking had always been the smoothest part of our relationship, so I knew when Brett was hiding something. Our regular phone conversations had become stilted, and I could feel the warmth in his voice slipping away. I'd ignored what I knew to be true, even in high school. Brett tried to come out to me twice before he actually said the words, "I'm gay." We'd both talked about the fact that we were attracted to people who shared our respective representations of gender, and many of those who did not. But we always made it a point to note that ultimately, in the mess of all that desire, we wanted to be with each other, first and most. We would never give each other up. And more importantly, he would never give up on me. That's why it took so long for him to say what he needed to say. He loved me, and he wanted to want me. He didn't want to let me go. We had been in a relationship for 6 years and were best friends for longer. He was my safest place, and he knew that was the case, had seen it for himself. We didn't know back then. There are about a million ways to love and be loved by another person. We thought what we had, the way we had it, was the only way it could be. We were stuck. He called me first. When I answered, his sobbing choked the phone line, and I spent an intolerable amount of time saying, "What? What?" into the receiver. When he caught his breath, steadied his voice, and finally said the words, I wept on my end of the call. I told him he had to come see me, in person. He had to say it to my face. I had no idea what life would look like without him, and I tried to picture it while I waited for him to arrive. He'd been my focal point, and often the guiding force for every decision I'd made over 6 years. I hadn't put me before we since I was 14 years old, not wanting to go back to being the only person in the world who really knew who I was. There was no one I trusted to take care of me more than Brett. I knew who I was without him. I knew being apart would hurt, but it would not kill me. I had no idea what I should do with myself or who I should ask for directions to wherever I was supposed to end up next. Was I supposed to know? Brett was the first man to hold me with desperation. Like if he didn't hold on to every part of me all at once, he might find himself in a million pieces on the floor. Our love affair had been passionate in its way, but that's not the portion that made me feel wild with grief at the thought of losing him. It was the safety and the acceptance of my shame. That's why it was so hard to let him go. Because of the way he held and rocked me when I told him I'd found out why my father was in prison. Because I knew no one else would ever know what I looked like curled up in his lap, soaking his t-shirt with my tears, trying to fold myself into nothing. No one else would ever see the way he desperately clung to my legs the night he came to my dorm room and repeated that he was gay, and I tried to leave the room. Or the way he fucked me 20 minutes later and slept all night with one arm thrown across my waist to anchor me beside him. Not one person, aside from the two of us, would know it was the last time we were intimate with each other this way. We made it 2 more months after that night, chained to one another by time, promises, and the overwhelming fear that if we couldn't have each other this specific way, then we could not have each other at all. After everything, he still let go first. I held on longer, scared not to be with him. That fear never changed. I'm still angry with him for that fear being inside me. I still love him for his desperation, for clinging to me like I was enough to keep pretending for one more night. But it wasn't his fault alone. For 2 months, we were both pretending. I was pretending to love him the same way I always had, and he was pretending to love me differently.